Good evening. The Trump administration blames Iran for attacks in the Gulf of Oman, Flint, Michigan, and remembering pot activist Doug Green. With these and other stories, I'm Paul DiRienzo with the news for Friday, June 14th, 2019. The United States on Friday blamed Iran for attacks on two oil tankers at the entrance to the Gulf and said it was seeking international consensus about the threat to shipping, despite Tehran denying involvement in the explosions at sea. Trump told Fox News, "Iran did do it, and you know they did it because you saw the boat." He was referring to a video released on Thursday by the U.S. military, which said it showed Iran's Revolutionary Guards placing mines that struck the Norwegian-owned Front Altair and the Japanese-owned Kokuka Courageous in the Gulf of Oman at the mouth of the Persian Gulf. Defense Secretary Patrick Shanahan said Trump's administration is focused on building international consensus here following the attacks.
Secretary Pompeo and Ambassador Bolton have been very, very helpful. But I think, as you can tell, we have an international situation there in the Middle East. It's not a U.S. situation. And the focus for myself and Ambassador Bolton and Secretary Pompeo is to build international consensus to this international problem. And as all of you are very aware, the Department of Defense, one of our roles is to set the conditions for diplomacy. And what I would share with you, and this is in part from a lot of the conversations that we all have had about transparency and getting intelligence out, you'll see we had the big push in the last 24 hours to continue to get information out, continue to share intelligence, and you'll continue to see us work to do that as part of building the international consensus. I'd also say that the chairman, and then in close coordination with General McKenzie, we're making sure that General McKenzie and the Central Command has the resources and the support that they need to conduct their missions.
Mr. Secretary, do you believe
oil prices rose by about 1% on Friday, reflecting the jitters. Insurance costs for ships sailing through the Middle East have jumped by at least 10% after the attacks. That's according to ship insurers. Scott Ritter is a former nuclear weapons inspector in Iraq. He says there's no threat to the United States, but that a war might not be as easy as American leaders are predicting.
Iran does not pose an existential threat to the United States, so there's nothing about the current situation that represents a threat worthy of the United States going to war. The United States, on the other hand, does pose an existential threat to Iran. We've been engaged in a program of maximum pressure designed to cripple the Iranians economically. It's having some success, but not enough success to get Iran to back away from its undertakings that the United States finds objectionable. So one has to take a look at the current incidents in the Gulf with some skepticism. Who stands to benefit from it? Iran certainly doesn't. Those in the United States who are posturing for a military confrontation with Iran do.
Do you think this is a false flag, as the Iranians are saying, or were they out there in their boats planting mines on ships, and is that something we should take into consideration?
I don't think the evidence is conclusive either way. The fact of the matter is, Iran has said that it has the capability of shutting down the Strait of Hormuz. The United States, of course, has repeated over and over again that Iran cannot do this, and if Iran attempts to do this, the United States will open the Strait immediately. The United States is just absolutely wrong on this. One, Iran can shut down the Strait of Hormuz at will. It can shut it down anytime it wants to. And once it shuts it down, it will be shut down permanently until Iran decides to reopen it. There's nothing the United States could do to prevent that. We lack the military capacity to keep the Strait open. If we attempt to keep the Strait open through force, we will suffer casualties. It's just 100% advantage Iran. Furthermore, if we seek to escalate to a military strike, Iran's counterstrike will not only keep the strait open, it will destroy the oil-producing infrastructure of its neighbors, Kuwait, Saudi Arabia, Oman, the United Arab Emirates, and they know this. It could be in Iran's benefit just to make a demonstration of capability, to say, this is just a taste of what will happen. However, it's not in Iran's benefit to make this demonstration. They don't need to make this point. This point is known by everybody. These attacks do, however, create a rise in tension that could lead to providing a trigger point for the use of military force by the United States, which is something that's being pushed by elements in the Trump administration, not by the president himself, but by John Bolton, by Mike Pompeo, and by others, and also by regional allies in Saudi Arabia, in Israel, and elsewhere, who believe that it's imperative that the United States confronts Iran militarily. This is more likely a false flag or a provocation by a non-Iranian entity than it is something that the Iranian government is undertaking in its own right.
Scott Ritter is a retired Marine and former nuclear weapons inspector in Iraq. The Middle East Research Associate for the Institute for Policy Studies is Corey Peterson-Smith. He says the current situation in the Gulf of Oman holds the potential for bloody conflict.
This is extremely dangerous, what's happening, and this latest flare-up in the Persian Gulf is just the latest indication of it, but it is also totally predictable result of the U.S. really escalating the situation with Iran over the past few months through pulling out of the Iran nuclear deal, escalating the sanctions on Iran, deploying a carrier group to the Gulf of Oman, sending more troops in the region, the list goes on. So it's really terrifying, and it's absolutely a predictable result of the U.S. escalating the situation.
Is this entirely the fault of the U.S.? Does Iran have any blame?
These are two nation states that are competing over territory. So it's not the case that Iran is totally blameless, but Iran was, I mean, if we just back up the timeline, for the past few years, Iran has actually been cooperating on de-escalating tensions with the U.S. It became party to the nuclear deal and so on. So the indication has been that Iran has been willing to work with the U.S., and it's actually the U.S. that has reversed course under the Trump administration and escalated things. It's not a question of Iran being totally blameless, but it's clearly the United States is playing the primary role in escalating things, not only with Iran, but encouraging Europe to have worse relations with Iran, just escalating things in the region and actually around the world in terms of Iran.
Is the United States going to be able to put together a coalition of the willing, as they called it, back in the Iraq War this time around? Will there be other countries of any significant force that will back the U.S.?
It's a good question, and it's actually unclear to me what the U.S. really wants. I mean, I think that there are different figures in the Trump administration that want different things. John Bolton is always game to attack Iran. That's not necessarily true with others in the Trump administration, let alone the various U.S. allies around the world. So it doesn't seem like the rest of the world is itching for a war. And it's actually not clear what the Trump administration wants.
What effect have the sanctions had on Iran?
Economic sanctions are always, the claim is always that they target different people in whatever regime the sanctions are put on, but they always affect the people. And so for Iranian people, the economy has just been a disaster. It's impossible to survive because the sanctions have meant that trade has gone down with Iran. It's just been a real nightmare. A lot of basic goods can't get to Iranians. So this has really been devastating for Iranian society.
Are we going to see like a full-scale invasion, in your opinion, like we saw in Iraq?
Truthfully, it's not clear. The hope is that whether Iran or the various other, let's back it up. The Persian Gulf, as we know, a huge portion of the world's oil travels through the Straits of Hormuz, somewhere between a fifth and a third. Putting aside the humanitarian reality, which is, you know, that should be our primary concern, there are all kinds of governments around the world that are concerned because this would have a tremendous impact on countries that are dependent on the oil that flows through those straits. And so the hope is that of those various governments that are connected to the situation, that there would be some effort to kind of de-escalate things. But the fact is, if there was a military confrontation, it would be devastating. The U.S. invasion of Iraq was an absolute catastrophe. When the U.S. invaded Iraq in 2003, Iraq had been weakened by over a decade of U.S. sanctions, and that is not the situation with Iran. I mean, the sanctions have been devastating, but this is a powerful country in the region, so this would not be an easy invasion from the perspective of the United States, and And really, the hope is that we can avoid this war. Saudi Arabia has been encouraging the whole world to kind of pile on Iran, and then all kinds of things that Saudi Arabia is doing, including its catastrophic war with the United States and the UAE in Yemen, this is justified as really getting at Iran, which is just, it's just false. So it's not just the United States. U.S. allies are absolutely also part of this escalation, and it's very scary.
And the Houthi war in Yemen, is that a proxy war related to what's happening now?
It is framed as a proxy war by Saudi Arabia and by the United States, and it's really false. The Houthi rebels who are fighting with the Yemeni official government, which is backed by Saudi Arabia, they do have some alignment with Iran, but this is not a proxy war. I mean, the Houthis are not, for example, the kind of analogy that's put forward is that the Houthis are like Hezbollah in Lebanon, which is a party that is directly carrying out Iranian interests and funded and so on by Iran. This is a very different kind of situation. This is really about Yemen's own society and history and politics. And Saudi Arabia and the United States are framing things in terms of this being a proxy conflict. And, of course, it's the Yemeni people who are paying this disastrous price, with the UN calling Yemen, the situation in Yemen, the most disastrous humanitarian situation in the world.
So you're sort of pessimistic about what might happen ultimately, and just your last comments.
There's a lot of unknowns, and it's actually not clear what the United States itself wants. The Trump administration is not speaking with a united voice in terms of what exactly it wants in Iran. But what we do know is that the actions of the Trump administration, from deploying more troops to the Middle East to deploying more military vessels to the Persian Gulf, to the Straits of Hormuz, the Gulf of Oman, to deploying B-52 bombers, it's the United States that is escalating the situation. And any notion that this is Iran escalating things, it's simply wrong. It's Iran that has been willing to de-escalate things. I don't look to the governments of the world, and certainly the U.S. government, that the challenge is for the people of the world to, as we did when the U.S. was about to invade Iraq, what can we do to challenge our government and stop this?
Corey Peterson-Smith is the Middle East Research Associate for the Institute for Policy Studies. And in national news, friends and relatives of a black man who was killed by a federal fugitive task force in Tennessee have peacefully gathered near the site of the shooting. A few dozen people gathered Thursday evening near the Memphis house where 20-year-old Brandon Weber was killed Wednesday. Protesters on Wednesday night had reacted to the shooting by throwing rocks and bricks, injuring 36 law enforcement officers. On Thursday, a couple of men spoke with megaphones as others sat in parked cars talking among themselves. Weber's father was present. Some motorists who drove by honked their horns and shouted messages of encouragement. There was a light police presence with a couple of police cars parked at a nearby fire station that was damaged during Wednesday's unrest. And more than 5 years ago, the city of Flint, Michigan, switched its water source and exposed nearly 100,000 residents to lead-tainted drinking water. Since then, the state has failed to hold anyone accountable. Now the Department of Attorney General is dropping all charges related to the investigation, including an involuntary manslaughter charge against a top health official. The department announced its decision on Thursday, noting in a release that it was made with the intent of launching a new, full, and complete investigation. The old administration under Attorney General Bill Schuette initiated the current investigation, and current Attorney General Dana Nessel took office this year promising to go harder than her predecessor, apparently killing the investigation after the state spent more than $30 million on it is her team's strategy. Mark Edwards is a professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech and an expert witness in the case. He says a crime was committed, but the crime encompasses much more than Flint.
Those who are guilty should be punished. The problem is that there were four scientists and engineers at the Michigan Department of Environmental Quality who are widely acknowledged to have broken the law. And unfortunately, they were deemed little fish in the grand scheme of things, and the special prosecutor made a deal with them and kind of gave them a little slap on the wrist in pursuit of bigger fish. And the case against the bigger fish now looks very, very weak. Some of the prosecutor's theories look dubious. The witnesses that they brought forth, many, I believe, lack credibility. And the case was in danger of imploding today because there was a motion to quash. And so had they delayed they would have lost their opportunity for prosecution. So they need to reboot and just start over.
What's the problem with this? How come they can't prove that anybody did something wrong when obviously a lot of people suffered?
Those three or four individuals did something wrong, and they actually plea bargained and admitted their guilt. The problem is they only got a slap on the wrist, misdemeanor, and unfortunately that raised expectations in many people's minds that there would be bigger fish paying a serious price, because the idea is you're using the little fish to get the bigger fish, but now that theory's imploded. I was involved in some of the cases, and the evidence that they were presenting against the so-called bigger fish just didn't hold up.
What happened, in your opinion?
It's a national scandal. In the aftermath of Flint, we learned that the only thing unusual about Flint is they got caught. Cheating and drinking water was something we were screaming about for the prior decade. And eventually, in the aftermath of Flint, people realized that even in their own cities, they were being unprotected. It's both a culture of cheating on a particular law, wherein I guess it's the equivalent of being in a certain state where the posted speed limit's 55 and everyone just thinks they can drive 95 and get away with it. except, unfortunately, breaking this law damages children's futures and maybe even resulted in some deaths. And there were national causes, there were state causes, there were unethical scientists and engineers. There's so much blame to go around, it's really hard to figure out how to divide it up.
What is the problem that America faces as a whole, as a country, with its water, with its drinking water?
On the whole, our water is safe, and we do a good job delivering a decent quality product at very, very low cost. The biggest problems are lead, which is something historically that's been a government conflict of interest, because the government owns the lead pipes, and they tend to downplay the health effects and cover it up, and this has been going on for 150 years. So lead is unique. I think the bigger problem we have is just our poorest cities and towns don't have enough money to meet federal law, much less improve their system. And so for cities like Flint that have lost a lot of their population, or thousands of towns across America that have lost population, they really don't enjoy civilization as we know it. They have sky-high water bills, and many times they have water that doesn't meet federal safety standards.
So this is a problem that faces basically the poorest, most vulnerable people in the country.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think what Flint has shown us is if you're judged by how you treat your most vulnerable, we in America do not look very good. And there are hundreds, if not thousands, of Flints out there, but we'll just never hear about them on the national news.
Is it safe now to drink the water in Flint?
The water is meeting current federal safety standards, but you know, I would hesitate to call any water in America perfectly safe. Even bottled water has some risks. Flint has been meeting federal safety standards now for almost 3 years. That doesn't mean people feel safe drinking the water, and that doesn't mean that drinking water is risk-free, because there's problems with water everywhere.
They basically replaced all the pipes?
They're on their way, and that will be a good thing, but they still have decrepit, antiquated water mains that are leaking water. They have sky-high water bills, and there's no relief in that in sight. So Flint is still suffering a financial and infrastructure crisis, and I hope we don't repeat the health crisis. The real issue here is that we look the other way. We live a lie. We pretend that these problems aren't happening. And when folks are put in this impossible situation and they make mistakes, why are we surprised?
Mark Edwards is professor of civil engineering at Virginia Tech and an expert witness in the Flint water crisis case. And in New York State, farmers are hoping marijuana could be their next cash crop. The New York Farm Bureau issued a memo Monday backing a bill that would legalize, tax, and regulate marijuana in New York, which lawmakers are considering before they end their annual session June 19th. The bill, which is struggling to gain enough support in the Democrat-led Senate, includes measures meant to ensure struggling farmers in New York's poorer counties get a chance to break into the marijuana and hemp extract industries. That was enough to garner the support of the organization representing thousands of farms in the state. And finally, in New York City, the movement to legalize marijuana lost a tireless activist last week. Longtime Empire State Normal, that's the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, member Doug Green died in a subway accident on June 4th. According to police, Green was fatally struck by an A train after he fell onto the subway tracks on the Upper West Side Tuesday night at the 72nd Street Station near Central Park West just before 10:45 p.m. Green, a music lover and committed vegan, was returning from a George Clinton concert earlier that night in Central Park. His loss was deeply mourned, says his friend Steve Bloom, who's editor-in-chief of Freedom Leaf, a pro-pot magazine.
Well, he was such a major player in the New York legalization movement, and it's ironic that he passes away several days before there might be a vote to legalize marijuana in New York, which he worked so hard on to make happen. Let's hope it passes, and maybe they'll name the bill for him.
What was his role? Did he actually write this legislation? How did he have so much access in Albany?
No, obviously not. You know, this is Liz Krueger's legislation. It's been amended recently because Governor Cuomo had his own ideas, and so they've kind of combined the two, the Marijuana Regulation and Taxation Act. It's been, out there for the last few years. Famously, Doug was the guy who was reading the hundreds of pages, and he was at a recent Canagather event, and he was hailed for his just interest in the subject, and there he was holding on to, all these pages that he was working his way through. Just something that he was deeply involved in, but in the last year or two, when legalization is really starting to take hold and multiple states are passing the laws, and mostly out west, and here in New York and in the Northeast, it's mostly have to pass it through legislation, which is much harder. It's tough enough to pass an initiative, although generally they pass when it's a vote because people like to vote for legalization, but it takes a lot to get it on the ballot. With legislation, we've never seen it happen yet until just a week or two ago when Illinois passed legislation for legalization. So that was really the first. Vermont did it as well, but Vermont didn't allow for a commercial market. The Illinois law will allow for a commercial market. So actually there was a precedent that New York can possibly follow now.
California, Colorado, these other states, Washington, Oregon, that have legalized marijuana, it's really been about people voting propositions that are on the ballot rather than their state representatives and the governor signing a bill to that effect.
That's why it's so much harder, and that's why Doug works so hard, because it's that much more effort to convince your local senators and assemblymen to agree to this. And even here in New York right now, we're two votes away. Two votes can stand between legalizing marijuana because they just can't get enough people. Maybe by Wednesday it'll shift and they'll hopefully vote on it, and hopefully those two votes will come over to the right side. But that's really where it's at. It needs 32 votes and they have 30.
Doug Green's legacy? What legacy does he leave?
He leaves a legacy of somebody who really cared a lot about a lot of things, by the way. He was a vegan. He cared about animal rights. He was a music lover and he was a marijuana legalizer. And he devoted his life to so many causes. Again, maybe he didn't think about himself enough. And I'm not saying that's the reason why Doug passed. There's a freak accident. But one thing leads to another. You're not thinking about yourself enough. He was always thinking about everybody else and trying to help and trying to make things better. And he's not with us anymore, but he's inspired all of us, to really work hard. And let's hope this week, this Wednesday, the legislature makes the right decision, and it'll be partially due to Doug.
Steve Bloom is editor-in-chief of Freedom Leaf, a pro-pot magazine. Doug Green left a sister and mother. He was 52 years old. And that's some of the news for Friday, June 14th, 2019. The news was produced with Linda Perry. Our engineer is Reggie Johnson. The music is George Clinton. For the WBAI Evening News, I'm Paul DiRienzo. Thanks for joining us.
I don't know where I learned to do that. I thought he was some love never knew. But one thing love could forget that.